Good afternoon and welcome to this week's Money Talk. My name is Simon Webster and I am the Money Talk Guru from Facts and Figures Financial Planners. We're based in Ashford. If you want to interact with the show, please feel free to tweet us at moneytalk_guru, and very shortly you'll be able to check out the Money Talk website at moneytalk.guru. It's about to happen. I was signing off on it only last night. Today is Q&A day. I'm reacting totally to this week's events and questions, so if you want a question answered, then tweet moneytalk_guru or email sw@fffp.co.uk. I can't promise we'll get to your question this week because we've got a pretty packed show already, but if you do come into the show, then we will get your question dealt with next week. I can't start by passing on what to me was one of the saddest stories of the week. Robin Williams' suicide. Perhaps a strange topic to start, but I simply love the guy. I'm old enough to remember Mork and Mindy and Mrs. Doubtfire, Dead Poets Society and Good Morning Vietnam were just three of his stellar film credits, films I really loved. He was genuinely a true comic genius, and from what I hear, he was a pretty genuinely warm and kind guy, truly at the top of his profession. But here's the thing. He was successful, he had a loving family around him, and he had lots of money. And this is why we called the show Money Talk rather than Talks, because it's not money that matters, it really is those people and relationships that matter. And the tragedy for Robin's family is that a man at the top of his game took his own life because due to ill health, his mind was playing tricks on him. If any good is to come from this tragedy, I think we must all be a little more sympathetic to those with mental health issues. There has been a tendency in the past, for particularly those of a certain age, to brush off such things as a touch of the blues. And if this tragedy teaches us anything at all, it is that mental illness can hit anybody at any time. And that provides a link to the main topic of the show, and we'll get to that in a second. But when you've got a problem, talk to somebody. We all have lots of people around us, but I think that famous old quote about the mass of men leading lives of silent desperation is just so true. And so many people carry so much stuff and don't want to appear weak, don't want to burden their friends, are worried about looking stupid. And the truth is, the person they're worried about sharing it with is probably sitting on their own stuff, and they need some support too. So when you've got a problem, talk to somebody. And you've got an issue like Robin had, then talk to some professionals and do it now. Changing the subject back to the main theme of the day, I am indebted to my Facebook friends for a series of questions for this morning's show. Brian Kelly's comment was that shows like this should be about education, education, education. And I never thought I would find myself regularly quoting Tony Blair. But in that, he was absolutely right. As was Brian. I totally agree. As a professional financial advisor, I never cease to be amazed by the level of financial illiteracy in the young, and indeed sometimes amongst the grown-ups. But money is not taught in our schools. And dare I say it, many younger parents in particular do not have the skills themselves, so they can't pass them on to their kids. There's been much in the papers today about Gove's legacy being a toughening up of examination standards, and I think this year for the first time we've seen examination results overall slide slightly. He was wont to bang on incessantly about the three R's, reading, writing and arithmetic, But as an employer, I never cease to be amazed by the naivety and flat-out ignorance on financial matters that many job applicants to my own firm actually exhibit. And there's a paucity of the other life skills necessary to grasp before entering the world of work. It really is an education issue, and I think society at large, we as parents or school governors and politicians, please note, need to really address this, because as an employer, I can't really take somebody on who doesn't understand just a little bit about money and how it works. I work in the trade, but there are a load of jobs for which basic life skills are essential, and kids are presenting themselves without a basic ability to demonstrate those skills. It's a real sad thing. Our first topic today, our first main topic, requested by Brian Kelly and Mike Saunders, is budgeting. Dickens' Micawber made a very famous and oft-quoted remark in his Recipe for Happiness. Annual income, £20. Annual expenditure, £19, 19 shillings and 6 pence. Result, happiness. Annual income, £20. Annual expenditure, £20, ought and 6. Result, misery. I think most of us know that David Copperfield Micawber spoke those words in David Copperfield. The Telegraph actually published 12 Dickens money-related quotes. I've picked two more because they're relevant. In Great Expectations, Pip's extravagant lifestyle, furnishing his rooms and wining and dining in London, certainly had parallels to today's buy-now-pay-later mentality. Fueled, I think, by those television adverts that some of us will remember for Access, your flexible friend. So now, as an infallible way of making little ease, great ease, I began to contract a quantity of debt. So said Charles Dickens in Great Expectations. And Dickens' vivid description could just as easily be applied to the dangers of some payday loans today. And I think Einstein had a subject on this. The father of this pleasant grandfather, of the neighbourhood of Mount Pleasant, was a horny-skinned, two-legged, money-getting species of spider who spun webs to catch unwary flies and retired into holes until they were entrapped. The name of this old pagan's god was Compound Interest. And I think Einstein described compound interest as the greatest force in the universe. So even in Dickens' day, money management and debt were true issues in society. But how does one construct a budget today? Well, a few things from sort of a macro level, top down, having a look at the issues to consider. Simon's rule number one, avoid borrowing to fund lifestyle. When the bank first gives you a credit card, the one thing you should not do is rush out and buy a new tablet computer, a new phone, more clothes or trainers, unless you have the cash to pay that credit card debt off at the end of the month. Credit cards are one of the great conveniences of modern society, but they are a tool to make life easier. You can go into a shop and buy what you need without having to carry a load of cash around, but you must pay your credit card off at the end of every month. You must pay your credit card off at the end of every month. I never cease to be amazed by the number of people who have made a conscious decision to fund an over-extravagant lifestyle on credit cards. Do not ever do this. Dickens was right. Compound interest is a bitch. For the record, store cards are usually more expensive. So if you think you may not be able to control yourself with a card, tear it up. Do it now. Payday loans are worse still. So use a credit card for day-to-day living. That's fine. No problem with that at all. But by the same token, pay it off at the end of the month. Avoid store cards. Avoid payday loans. And just for the record, I don't have a problem with debt per se. My basic rule is that it's okay to borrow to invest, particularly in property, perhaps in a car if you must, or for tools for work and education, but avoid borrowing for lifestyle. turn down expensive invitations to weddings or stag and hen doons when you would have to borrow to travel or stay? When do you think you'll get enough money to pay off that debt, plus the interest, which will continue ratcheting up until you do pay it off? A quick by the by. Check whether you qualify for working tax credit. If you are aged between 25 and 59 and work more than 30 hours a week, and if you have no children but earn less than £18,000, you can claim for free money from the government. If you have children and earn a bit more, you can also claim. It's free money. So check it out on the www.gov.uk website. Just search working tax credit. And if you have children, there's also child tax credit, and the two go together. But these benefits do not come to you automatically. You have to claim. And there is no shame in claiming for these benefits. In your life, you will pay lots of tax. This is just a way of getting some of it back when you're starting out. It's also worth checking whether you're entitled to any other benefits. I'm not an expert, and saying this makes me think I need to get an expert in. So if you are one or know one, please get them to tweet the show, moneytalk_guru, or email sw@fffp.co.uk, and we'll have a section on benefits in a future show. Back to overall budget considerations. Choose where you're going to live very carefully. Generally, it's more expensive to live near city centres. But equally, it can be very expensive to commute. If you are likely to go out in town in the evening, remember taxis home to the sticks can get very expensive the further out you live. Factor those sort of costs in. Stage 1, do that maths. Clearly, if you're part of an established household, you may be stuck, and there may be different family members heading in different directions. But think it through. And do remember that commuting takes a toll on your general energy, and it uses up a lot of time. Another budget factor. Do what you can to trim utility costs. The cost of utilities has risen exponentially in recent years. Fossil fuel taxes, the general price and scarcity of oil and gas have driven prices up through the roof. And at the moment, there's a big debate as to whether nuclear is safe, and there is an argument about how much it's going to cost long term. Either way, anybody who runs a household will see a significant proportion of their monthly income disappear to pay the gas, electricity, and oil bills. Can you afford it? So have a look. What can you do to save? Don't put the heating on in every single room if you're not going to be there. Have you insulated your roof and your walls? There are grants available. Check it out on your local authority website. But there are grants available. Have you got double glazing? Some basic things to think about. But do anything you can think of to trim your utility costs. It can be horrendously expensive, and you really need to do everything you can to take advantage of any savings that you can possibly make. So we thought about some of the things that might be in your budget, but what about some of the things that might not automatically be in your budget? Ask yourself what happens to your income if you're too sick to work. If you're self-employed or you work for an employer with no sick pay, just remember statutory sick pay is effectively no sick pay at all. So if you're not going to get any form of sick pay, you might need to consider buying some health insurance to provide that income if you become long-term sick. It might be wise to consult an independent financial advisor, such as the team at Facts and Figures. You can find us at www.fffp.co.uk. If you have a mortgage and or financial dependents, you might need to consider life insurance. In fact, if you just pay rent, you might need to consider life insurance, because if you have a family and you are unable to work or not around, how's that rent going to be paid if you're not around? So you might need to consider life insurance. If you die, how much would your family receive in income? How much would your family receive as a lump sum? It's probably not very much. The death grant from the state is a staggering £2,000, which will barely pay for a funeral. So you need to factor in the cost of some family protection, some life insurance, some mortgage protection. Think about it. And again, consult an independent financial advisor. The team at Facts and Figures would be delighted to help. Having taken care of the people, is your stuff insured? It might be all very well having the greatest stereo and tablet computers and bits and pieces, but if somebody nicks them, how will you be possibly in a position to afford to replace them? Transfer that risk of loss to an insurance company. And if you've got an insurance policy, are you getting a halfway decent deal? I had a hell of a shock this week. I won't tell you what I'm paying for buildings and contents insurance, but it's into four figures. And I went to another broker and they were able to halve my premium with a reputable insurer. It pays to really pay some attention to this because, again, it's a huge bill and significant savings can be made. And lastly on this subject, sort of strategic budget issues, what about when you're too old to work? Much of what we've talked about on this show in recent weeks has been to do with pensions. But the first step in pension planning is actually to put some money away every month. 10% of income is probably a good place to aim for as a starting point. But how you come at this will depend on where you are. If you're just setting up for your first job, then you might take the view that you can actually budget 10% from day one. If you're already in a situation where your budget is overextended, you might have to build up to it slowly over time. But either way, start thinking about your pension. The earlier you start, the less it will cost you overall. And I said lastly, but in fact there is one further thought. Putting some money aside for contingencies is always wise. 3 months' income is oft cited as a good place to start. But if you can, put a few quid away every month so that on that faithful day when the car fails its MOT or some other unexpected disaster or expense rears its head, you don't have to consider funding it with debt. And that has to be a good thing. Well, I think I've talked for enough. It might be time for a quick break.
Channel Radio, broadcasting from Hagland's Village on Romney Marsh, 24 hours a day. Channel Radio.
And now a little something from Dire Straits. I tried to play this on an earlier show, but we never got to it. So here, the unexpedited version. Mark Knopfler at the top of his game.
We got some movies, refrigerators. We got some movies. that's his own head. The little faggot got his own jet airplane. The little faggot, he's a millionaire. We got to install a microwave oven, custom kitchen deliveries. We got to move these refrigerators. We got to move these color
Mr. Knopfler, I am so sorry, but I've just worked out that I selected the album version of that song and it's going to run for another 5 minutes. So I'm going to leave that playing somewhere in cyberspace and come back to talking to you again. This is Simon Webster. You're listening to Money Talk, and today we're looking at budgets. When you make a budget, create a living document that can address unexpected increases in income or expenses, or helps you take advantage of opportunities that present themselves. To do this, create a document that lists your expected income and expenses and provides ongoing reports. In addition to a column that totals your income and expenses, create a column that tracks and shows your average monthly spending, one that compares it with your budgeted monthly spending, and one that projects where you'll be at the end of the year based on your current income and spending. Instead of using fixed contributions to retirement and home down payment funds, use percentages of your excess income each month. This will let you save more during good months and decrease your contributions to address times when cash is tight. But most of all, be realistic. When you make your initial budget, use last year's spending to guide you, but don't believe you'll decrease your discretionary spending just because you see it on paper. Some budgeters also try to make ends meet by decreasing spending unrealistically in some areas to make cash more readily available for other things. Over-budget for groceries. This is a common household item for people to fudge. Be flexible. You don't have to live with a budget if it's not working. If you're not meeting your financial goals, reassess your budget to see if you need to change your spending. Manage your cash flow. Don't make the mistake of setting monthly spending averages without addressing your actual month-to-month cash flow needs. For example, if you pay a monthly car insurance, address that in your budget. This may allow you to meet all your savings goals by changing the contribution amounts in different months. There are two ways of budgeting, what I call detail and big picture. Detail involves tracking all your expenditure, probably on a spreadsheet as I alluded above. It's quite painful, but it's absolutely worth it. The other way of doing it is what I call big picture. So let's start with a detail budget. In theory, you should know what comes in or what is going to come in each month. But if your income fluctuates, assume a low estimate and treat good months as a bonus rather than relying on good months to fund basic lifestyle essentials. Track your expenditure. It comes down to keeping a little notebook and writing everything down you spend. Once you know where your money comes from and where it goes, start to look at where perhaps you can save some money. The one that surprises a lot of people is how much they spend on sandwiches for lunch if they work in an office. £5 a day is not unusual, but that's over £100 a month, or £1,200 a year. Now, it still costs a bit to bring sandwiches from home, but it's infinitely less. It may not be so cool or so convenient, but it could be a huge saving, and £1,000 a year saving would pay for a holiday. The dynamic budget is a little bit more intuitive. Budgets have kind of a bad rap. If you're like most people, budgeting is probably not on your list of favourite things to do. In fact, if you're like most people, the very word budgeting probably makes you cringe just a little. After all, unless you're a serious financial geek, there's nothing particularly fun about creating those little spreadsheets and tracking all of your monthly expenses down to the penny. What's more, even after you've managed to grit your teeth and work through the month's worth of bills and day-to-day expenses, the end result is a rigid, nitpicky budget that goes completely out the window the minute you experience a change in your monthly expenses. The problem, it seems, is while that the idea of budgeting sounds useful, the actual practice of budgeting leaves a bit to be desired for a lot of people. So big picture budgeting can give you an alternative. Unlike some of the more uptight, detail-orientated budgets out there, big picture budgeting allows you to set some simple, flexible ground rules that make it easy to live within your means. If not easy, easier. No spreadsheets, no down-to-the-penny monthly calculations, just a little basic maths and a couple of hours. So how can you do that? Well, step one, add up your total monthly income. If you just work for a living and you get one paycheck, it might be a sum with one line. But you could have some other bits and pieces. You could have an income, your spouse or partner could have an income. And you could have interest from investments or side jobs or hobbies that actually pay you some money. That'll give you a grand total. Step two, add up your monthly living expenses. This should be familiar territory to anybody who's ever created any sort of budget. But in this case, monthly living expenses means typical things like mortgage, rent, credit card payments. Of course, you shouldn't have those. And any other financial commitments. It would include things like rent, car payment, groceries, insurance, utilities, phone, cell phone, internet, cable, credit card, other financial commitments, travel to and from work, and maybe allowing a discretionary amount. But we'll come on to that. Now, those expenses that I've just listed are your fixed expenses. Figure out what percentage of your monthly income goes towards fixed expenses. So I suspect the lower your income and the earlier you are in your working life cycle doing this, the higher the percentage of your income is pretty much fixed. You might come up with a number of 75, 80, 85%. How much of your money do you need to set aside each month to ensure that you can pay your bills, get to and from work, etc.? And one of the things you could do is, having decided that you need to put 85% of your money aside each month to pay the bills, open a bills account and simply transfer 85% of your money from your standard checking account into your bills account, and have all your direct debits and standing orders that go out regularly go out from that number two account. It's a great way of making sure that you don't go overdrawn and pay unnecessary bank charges. Once you've got that headline number, divide the rest of your monthly income into additional smaller chunks. So you can have a savings chunk, a retirement chunk. You can budget for things that you enjoy doing and just say, right, I'm going to allow 5% of my income for pure fun money. When you work all month and you actually only get 5% of your income to play with, it's probably a bit sad. But we've all got to start somewhere, and you really need to give this matter some serious thought, otherwise you're going to end up in trouble. So if you do all this and find out you're still spending more than you are earning, what can you do? Well, here's a few thoughts. I've already mentioned utilities, but turn off unnecessary lights. These days, cheap light bulbs, high-efficiency light bulbs, are much cheaper to run. So look at replacing with those. Turn the thermostat down a couple of degrees. Do anything else you can think of, including getting those grants for insulation or a new boiler. And there's grants available for that in some circumstances. All those things that can drive down your utility bills have got to be welcomed. Are you running the best value car? A member of my family found that she'd bought a fairly sensible car, cost her about £1,500. It was a diesel. It was relatively cheap in terms of fuel. But the blasted thing kept going wrong. And we worked out that in 1 year she paid something like £1,200 or £1,300 just in additional servicing and repairs. And that's after adding the cost of actually having that £1,500 or whatever it was tied up in the car. In the end, we decided her best bet was to lease a new one. Now, I've said earlier, getting into debt unnecessarily is not a good idea. But for my family member, putting herself in a new car has changed her life. She feels better about life, she gets where she wants to go on time, and for me, I don't have to worry about whether she's going to get there or whether she or her husband are going to get calls in the middle of the night saying the car's broken down. Not that she's out in the middle of the night that often, to be fair. I've already alluded to make your own sandwiches, but is there anything else that you can do that might help with your domestic expenditure? And always, always, always pay off your most expensive debt first. So payday loans, then store cards, then credit cards. But better still, don't get into debt on them. And just a general point here on budgeting. If you're in financial trouble, please, please, please don't suffer in silence. It goes back to the item at the head of the show. Talk to friends, talk to family. Dare I say it, talk to a financial advisor. Or better still, the Citizens Advice Bureau have specialist debt counsellors. But if you sit down sensibly and map out your financial expenditure, whether you want to do it in detail with a spreadsheet or in the big picture, whichever method works for you, write that budget and do your level best to stick to it. Because if you're on a fixed income and one month you go out on a binge of one sort or another and spend a lot of money you don't have, it could take you years, literally years, to pay it off. And that's a situation that nobody ever wants to be in.
West Kent. We offer ongoing work, weekly pay and a variety of shift patterns to suit your needs. Visit us at www.tempnetwork.co.uk or call Tunbridge Wells 531-777.
Now let's work it to the bone, bone, bone. Come on, work.
Too tired to mention.
I've got to find out who this Nancy is. No idea what that's got to do with the song, but there you go. Money Too Tight to Mention, Simply Red. Yes. If you're on a tight budget, talk to somebody. Said that before, but it's worth repeating. Now, time to change the subject. Had another question from Jan Newport, and she was asking about dealing with student loan debt. We seem to spend quite a lot of time on debt today. I'm not going to get into the fact whether the fact that students now have to go into debt is a good or bad thing. Clearly, it would be preferable if it wasn't necessary. But once you have a student loan, what is the position? Well, perhaps a little bit of background. It's probably worth saying why this has become something of a hot topic. And of course, the issue is having been £3,000 between 1998 and 2011, tuition fees rose to a maximum of £9,000 a year in 2012, almost treble the previous fee. The threshold for paying back student loans has risen to £21,000. Under the former system, this threshold was £16,900. Students under the new regime pay an above-inflation interest rate of up to 3%, which begins while they're still at university. Under the former system, there was no real rate of interest. Under the new system, graduates earning more than £41,000 pay more interest, up to a maximum of inflation plus 3 percentage points. This higher level threshold didn't exist before. Debts are now written off after 30 years compared with 25 years under the old system. So if you go to university and you rack up a student debt, how much do you actually have to pay? Well, the figure now is 9% of any income over £21,000. So on a monthly basis, if you earn £25,000 a year, you'll be paying £30 a month. If you earn £30,000 a year, you'll be paying £67. If you earn £40,000 a year, you'll earn £142. If you earn £60,000 a year, it'll be £292. Now, there is a very strong argument that says you wouldn't be earning £60,000 a year unless you had a decent university education. And I think there's a lot of mileage in that line of reasoning. But one of the things to think about, and it was publicised quite heavily, among other places, in the BBC recently, is that most students will still be paying back loans from their university days in their 40s and 50s. And many will never clear the debt, but it will be written off when they get to 55, I think I said earlier. Did I say 55? No, I said 50. But either way, almost three quarters of graduates from England will have at least some of their loan written off. The Sutton Trust says that the 2012 student finance regime will leave people vulnerable at a time when family costs are at a peak. Ministers replied that more students from less advantaged homes were taking up places because the repayment terms were so much more generous for lower earners. The study, entitled Payback Time, found that a typical student would now leave university with much higher debts than before, averaging more than 44 grand, which is a sizable amount of money. We estimate that under the new system, students will leave university with nearly £20,000 more debt, on average, in 2014 prices, £44,000 under the new system, compared with £24,750 under the old. And the vast majority of this increase is the result of the higher fee loans to cover higher student tuition costs. In cash terms, researchers estimate that graduates will now repay a total of £35,446 in 2014 prices. The report says that the lowest earning graduates, those whose salaries rarely go above £21,000, will pay back less under the new regime, while those who earn higher salaries will pay back substantially more. The decision to bring in a real above-inflation interest rate on student loans means that almost half, 45% of graduates, will pay back more than they have borrowed in real terms. However, even though large numbers of graduates will repay more than they borrowed, the vast majority will not return their loan in full. So the question is that system really working? And the answer is probably not. The example is cited of the average teacher who takes out an average level of loan, works every year after graduating and has an average earnings for the profession. It says that person would pay £25,000 in today's prices under the old system, but finishing their repayments by the time they are around 40. Under the new system, the same teacher would pay back around £42,000 in 2014 prices, but would not have finished paying back their loan by the time they're in the early 50s, and would have around £25,000 written off. So it's a real issue. Now, how does one deal with that situation? I think it's a really good question, and it's going to depend on where you are on a case-by-case basis. It seems daft not to take the highest-paying job you can get, even if that does mean that you have to repay some element of your student loan. But the reality is, if you're lucky enough to be earning £25,000 or £30,000 a year, that is significantly over national average wages. And I suppose people need to cut their cloth. A university education gives people a huge start in life. But the real question, I suppose, and I won't make myself popular by saying this, is there are some degrees that are really worth having, and some degrees that are, well, not so much. Now, my favourite whipping boy at the moment is media studies. I haven't really worked out what that means as an employer, but I have to confess that even somebody with a 2-1 or a first in media studies would not necessarily impress me. Now, some will say I'm a dinosaur for that. Well, maybe I am. But somebody showed up with a first in engineering, or a first in maths, or a first in physics, or geography, history, English, mathematics, those would really impress me, as would a 2-1 in any of those subjects. But the reality of the situation is there are an awful lot of slightly fuzzy degrees floating about, and I suppose students have to ask themselves the question, if they're going to get themselves into serious debt, possibly for a significant proportion of the rest of their lives, is the subject that they're choosing going to be worthwhile? University is a huge advantage. It's a huge learning opportunity. You learn life skills. You make friends that will last the rest of your life. There's a lot of opportunities. But in truth, it is also an investment. And you need, as a student, to make sure you're going to get yourself the best possible return on your investment. But just remember, you don't need to start repaying a student loan until you're earning over £21,000 a year. And that's darn near average earnings, and if you're on darn near average earnings as soon as you walk out of your university, you're not doing so bad, even if you've got to give a little bit of your student loan back. I had a question from Corinne Downs, who asked me, are premium bonds worth the money? Now, oftentimes, financial advisors sit on the fence with this sort of thing and come up with a whole pile of fudged answers. But on this one, I'm not. Because I was labouring under a misapprehension about premium bonds, I actually thought the prize pool was halfway serious. But it's not. It's based on an interest rate of less than 2%. And then you've got to win something to get a return. So my answer to the question, are premium bonds worth having, is a resounding no. Now, that's quite surprising because they are the biggest savings product in the UK with more than £49 billion tied up in premium bonds. And there are some hugely attractive prizes. They hold a prize draw every month with two £1 million jackpots. And if you're lucky enough to win it, then you're doing really well. But, of course, the problem is the jackpot odds are very similar to the National Lottery, which means not a lot. The annual prize interest rate, I said it was under 2%, is actually 1.35%. Now, taxes are prize-free. Goodness me, what's wrong with my mouth this morning? Prizes are tax-free, which probably makes the actual return worth about 2%. But the odds of a £1 bond winning a prize are shown below. And from 1st of August 2013, it was 26,000 to 1. To give you an idea, the higher value prizes, there are two £1 million prizes every month. There are four £100,000 prizes. There are seven £50,000 prizes. 15 at £25,000, 38 at 10 grand, 76 at 5 grand, 1,110 at £1,000, 3,330 at £500, 15,211 opportunities to win £100, 15,000 opportunities to win £50, and 1.8 million opportunities to win the staggering sum of £25, which wouldn't pay for dinner out for two. So is it worth going for premium bonds? My answer, I'm afraid, is no. You're much better off investing your money for the long term, unless you fancy sponsoring the government a bit with your hard-earned cash. Another question from Karen. Why won't anybody take a bag of coins anymore? Well, the simple answer is everybody's worked out how much time and hassle is involved in counting small change, and it takes staff at tills and counters a lot of time to count it, and then they've got to deal with it and put it away somewhere, and if there's people coming in with money the whole time, then they never get any work done. And at the end of the day, we're all in business to make money, I suppose. Now, my own bank, NatWest in Ashford, I never thought I'd hear myself giving my bank a plug, have got a coin machine, so you can show up with a sack full of money, drop it into the machine, it will count it, it will pay it directly into your account, and no human intervention is involved. So you can check whether your own bank or another local bank has such a machine and use it. And the good news is, such machines are free. There was a little state where our local Tesco's had a machine, and it was put in by some commercial company, and the commercial company was taking a rake off of your money. So you put your change in, and then you get a shopping voucher to use around Tesco for what you put in, less a little bit for the people that had the machine. I don't see that around there anymore. I think that was probably a bad idea, and it's moved on. But the reality of the situation is, it really needs to be, you really need to put your cash back in the bank, and if your bank's got a machine, you can do something with that. Now, I thought I had another tune, but in fact I don't, which means I'm going to move at this point straight to the news, and I need to look at my computer to get that on, and of course in the time that we've been on air, it's gone into suspend. So I will carry on rabbiting while this thing wakes up, and of course I can't type under pressure, I've messed it up, so we'll do it again, and with any luck, we'll be able to look at some of the financial news. One of the news items I saw earlier this week, which I thought was quite interesting, was ongoing concern about the mortgage market. It's actually a question that Alison MacDonald raised that I was going to come back to in a later show, because we've just done a programme on mortgages. But even today, mortgage lenders are saying prepare for a rate rise. Now, the problem with all this speculation is that it makes people very, very nervous. Because everybody thinks, oh, if there's a mortgage interest rate rise, I am going to be hundreds or thousands of pounds out of pocket, and it's really going to be an issue for me. I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't know how I'm going to deal with it. And they get really worried. But that was the situation 20 years ago, a situation I lived with when I took my original mortgage out. I think it was 5 or 6%, and then we got to Black Monday, and my mortgage had tripled to 15%, and needless to say, like a lot of other people, I couldn't afford to pay it. Now we live in a situation where interest rates are low and likely to remain a lot lower than their historical average for a good long time to come. It's very hard to predict what's going to happen next week, never mind next year or in 10 years' time, but most of the pundits say that Thatcher started the low inflation culture, which continues to this day, and the current economic situation has caused us all to start thinking in terms of a lower interest rate culture going forward. So what would a mortgage interest rate rise mean in practice? Well, if you have a loan of £100,000, 1% of £100,000 is, surprise, surprise, £1,000, or £83.33 per month. So if your mortgage went up by 1%, it would cost you £83.33 per month. But the reality is, a 1% mortgage interest rate rise in the next year will not happen. I will stick my neck out and say I could almost guarantee that mortgage interest rates will not go up by 1% in the next year. And I shall be very surprised did they go up by 1% over the next 2 or 3 years. The next rise in bank base rate will almost certainly be a quarter of 1%. Speculation is rife as to when that will be. Maybe at the end of this year. Depends on what's happening, because interestingly today they were publishing statistics showing that the recovery in the Eurozone has flatlined. Europe is actually experiencing zero growth. Germany has contracted, albeit only just a little bit. France has contracted significantly, and Italy is back in recession. So there are some huge challenges in the Eurozone, and we are directly linked with Europe, whether we want to be or not. So I think us putting our rates up at this stage is very unlikely, and what's just happened in Europe has probably pushed out the expectation date a little bit further. So I think the worry about mortgage interest rates being pushed up significantly anytime soon has been severely overhyped, severely over-egged. And I think people need to plan for it. They need to budget that they're at some stage over the next 3, 4, 5 years, their payments will go up by £83 per month per £100,000 borrowed. But it isn't going to be anytime soon. Now, one good thing that you can do to prepare for that is to start saving, say, £83 per month for each £100,000 that you have borrowed in a savings account, so that when rates do go up by 1%, which they'll do in several stages over the next 2 or 3 years, in my guess, then it won't be such a huge shock when it happens, and you'll have built yourself a little savings buffer. What news on property prices, I hear you ask? Well, there was another report out today saying that London prices have started to slow, and in some areas of London, they have started to fall. Now, there's a new cap been put on borrowing. The Financial Conduct Authority has stipulated that lenders may only lend a very small percentage of their total borrowing at more than 4.5 times income, which means only the very best, squeaky cleanest borrowers will be given that sort of facility. And the sort of people it's probably going to be aimed at as young professionals, young accountants, young lawyers, young doctors, where there is a serious career path with exponential income growth. If you're just an ordinary Joe in an ordinary job, I don't think that's going to be you anytime soon. The ECB, as I said earlier, is under real pressure. And the thing that they're under pressure for now is if the economy has slowed down, they've so far managed to reduce their interest rate at the ECB, the European Central Bank, to 0%. But what they're now being asked to do is what we've done in the UK and what the US has also done, which is to start printing money, effectively. We call it, oh my goodness me, the perishing term has gone. But it's printing money anyway. And the real issue there is that long term could be inflationary, and we've already said inflation is bad news. But the reality of the situation is that if they don't do something, there is a serious risk that economies can contract. What was interesting in all this gloom is that Portugal has actually moved from a 0.6% contraction in the first quarter to a 0.6% expansion in the second. And Spain, which has taken the medicine, has also continued to grow. Inflation in the Eurozone, conversely, fell to 0.4% in July, its lowest rate since 2004. But the risk of deflation, which is a fall in prices, which is actually very bad news for economy, is growing. French consumer prices fell 0.4% month on month, and Portugal's price index slumped by 0.7% in July. Spain saw the steepest slide in consumer prices in 5 years. Mario Draghi, who is the president of the European Central Bank, described Europe's recovery as weak, fragile, and uneven. And these figures certainly bear that out. The fall in output in Germany is likely to produce the biggest headlines, but the most serious problems reside elsewhere. Germany's problems are largely down to economic sanctions in Russia, with whom the Germans do a lot of business. And Germany's economy remains structurally sound. There are much greater concerns hanging over France, the region's second biggest economy, which has recorded zero growth for the second quarter in succession, and Italy, which has fallen into recession again. If the euro recovery is faltering or even going into reverse, there could be some serious problems. And the phrase I forgot, quantitative easing. What a lovely expression. But to anybody else, that's printing money. And if this European Central Bank starts pushing money out that it hasn't got, then that might fuel some economic recovery, but it will not do much for inflation statistics. And it's a real issue. Now, we're sitting on two or three fairly major trouble spots at the moment. Closest to home in Europe, we've got the Ukraine situation, and that casts a very long shadow. We've alluded to the fact that gas prices may rise, and we've already had export bans on moving goods to Russia, and those sanctions may tighten up, and that's going to have an impact on British companies trying to export to that area. The good news is we're not huge trading partners with Russia yet. But Putin is certainly making it difficult for us to do business in Russia, and that will have an impact on the UK economy, the Western economy, and indeed the world economy. And general instability caused by war and such sort of unrest is not good business for anybody. Then we have the situation in Iraq. The Islamic State is now spreading two countries. They're now trying to carve out their own little caliphate, or actually quite a large caliphate, and there are some real issues there. And that's going to destabilise the oil price. And then we've also got the situation in Gaza, where war and uncertainty, and if it's not full-out war, it's certainly armed conflict, is, again, destabilising the region. And what businesses want, as you've probably heard me say before, is peace, even taxation, steady monetary policy, and steady growth. Business hates surprises. It's very, very hard to plan for the future when there is instability. Now, younger people in society tend to like excitement. They tend to like things that are unexpected. It tends to be just generally exciting. But businesses and those who have to plan and invest and the people that create the jobs that we all rely on need that stability, and these trouble spots around the world are causing real issues. Economic news further. Asda reports increase in sales and market share. Asda said sales for 10 weeks to June increased, and the supermarket also improved its market share. Asda's owner Walmart cut forecasts for profits for 2014 as it invests in its online business. And it says it's paying for more for employee healthcare. Clearly that's in the US. But it doesn't alter the fact that sales at Asda shops open at least a year rose by 0.5%, and the business edged up its share of the shopper spend by 0.14%. Asda's rivals have lost customers to discounters like Lidl and Aldi. And obviously some to Asda. Despite Asda's improved performance, Walmart said trading conditions in the UK continue to be challenging. And clearly they are. Discounters Aldi and Lidl are booming at the expense of Tesco and Morrison's, research firm Kantar World Panel found last month. Of the big four supermarkets, only Sainsbury's and Asda managed to keep their share of the market. So there's some issues in the supermarket world there. Well, I think that's it for another show. I hope you found our conversations on budgeting of some use and some interest. We'll come back to looking at inheritance tax as suggested by Steve Osborne in a later show. We will doubtless return to the mortgage market, and we'll have a bit more to say about national savings and investment because they do have some attractive products that aren't premium bonds. But let me now say goodbye, and don't forget you can download the show to listen again or tweet the show to get some of your questions answered. Download at channelradio.co.uk, tweet moneytalk_guru, or email me, Simon Webster, the Money Talk Guru, at sw@fffp.co.uk. Thank you for listening, and goodbye until next time.